I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, a new report shows how people who need the assistance of government agencies for food, health care, and the ability to support their families face enormous obstacles in being able to access these dwindling benefits. And this is connected to the loss of public trust in government. Strong democracies rely on trust. Studies have shown that declining trust in key institutions correlate with openness to authoritarianism. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
August is Make-A-Will Month, and if TPR has made a difference in your life, consider making it part of your legacy. Visit tpr.org/legacy to learn how easy it can be to include Texas Public Radio in your estate plans.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. One of the most foundational challenges facing America today is the decline of trust in America's institutions. The news media, organized religion, the banking system, public schools, higher education, modern medical science, they're all seeing massive drops in public trust. Trust is necessary for a democracy to function, and the loss of trust opens the door to authoritarianism. A new report titled Barriers to Benefits, the Decline in Public Trust, connects these dots between how artificial barriers to public assistance for food and health care is adding to the loss of public trust. And we're joined by Omar Pabu. He is the Chief Executive Officer of Innovating for the Public Good, R&D for Democracy. And Omar, welcome to The Source.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me on.
This is an interesting report because, like I said, you connect dots. These are things that people may not automatically assume are sort of all in the same area or connected or in the matrix. But how do you look at the barriers to benefits when you look at Texas and some other states? And how does that lead to an overall decline in public trust? And also, how does that become something that weakens democracy?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. And, you know, this is obviously a problem that is affecting all parts of our society, but trust in institutions, trust in our government is really eroding people's beliefs and willingness to engage with our government. And, you know, the report we put out really focuses on contextualizing the impacts from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and how it will harm materially millions of Americans around the country by getting them off of benefits, but also close to 2 million Texans, and shows how those material benefits also have psychological impacts as well, and also broader societal impacts in terms of people's relationship with local government, with trust in the services they get, with belief that they're getting the support that they're entitled to. And that ultimately leads to just a broader breakdown in how people engage with one another, how they engage with the government, how they see their neighbors and who is deserving and who is not. When in fact, what this bill and these cuts are really doing is just taking people who are otherwise entitled to these benefits and making it harder for them to get on the rolls or stay on the rolls.
You look at the big, beautiful bill that was signed into law on July 4th by President Trump. It was a massive bill, big, beautiful bill. Some people, you know, have other names for that bill, which cut back on things like SNAP benefits, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, also TANF, which is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, Medicaid. A lot of public assistance programs are seeing slashes to these, but then there's more to that. They're adding complexities in order to be able to access the now reduced availability of assistance. How does that factor into your report?
Yeah, appreciate the question. And you're absolutely right. I mean, this bill is taking a real attach it to services that people have relied on for a very long time. And it is not a partisan perspective to say that these cuts are bad. I mean, before the bill was even fully written, we saw Senator Josh Hawley out of Missouri writing op-eds against the cuts, even though he ended up voting for it. But then we saw Senator Tom Tillis in North Carolina voting against the bill because of the impact it'll have on his constituents, on people on Medicaid and other services in his state. This is a real problem for people's ability to feed their families, to clothe their families, to get health care. And I want to stress that it is not solely because they are changing the requirements of who's eligible. It is mostly due to the fact that there are additional burdens being placed on people. So in Texas, to apply for the different types of benefits, there's fortunately a consolidated application. But that application is 30 plus pages long. And then on top of that, for people receiving SNAP, for example, they have to do interviews and recertify their eligibility on a regular basis. Now, these are the people in our community, our neighbors who are most vulnerable, who are facing probably the greatest amount of financial stress that any of us are facing, and are being asked to put on these additional burdens. So when we see drops in enrollment, it is because of these administrative burdens keeping people from being able to get on the rolls or stay on the rolls, not because they are ineligible or because they are undeserved.
So these Kafka-esque steps that have to be taken in order to get these benefits, you see this as what, punitive?
I see this as design.
But designed to punish people who need these benefits, or just are they going to make it so difficult so that that's one way to keep people from accessing them?
Exactly. And it's part and parcel with a broader narrative around shame that's associated with these kind of benefits, as opposed to seeing this as a way of supporting one another, as a way of seeing people as needing a little bit of help so they can have the opportunities that all of us are entitled to. And that's problematic. But we also need to think about that very big bill that you mentioned and how there are massive tax cuts for the wealthy, and those tax cuts have to be paid for somewhere. So there's definitely punitive measures against the people who are on these benefits, but also it is robbing them to basically put more money in the pockets of the wealthy. I mean, when you look at the numbers, the people who are really benefiting from this are those in the top income bracket. For those making over $3 million, we find that we saw from a report from Yale that $118,000 in additional gains are going to go to those families. That's a lot of money.
Right.
And it just further distorts and consolidates power.
And so you think that when people have contact with the government trying to get these services, these benefits that they have earned, because many of them have been taxpayers and have paid into the system. And now in their time of need, as the economy cools, then they have the experience that makes them feel like the system is not working, the government isn't working, and then they turn on democracy?
It's not necessarily that they turn on democracy, but they start feeling disillusioned by democracy, being disillusioned by the government, and looking for solutions that are normally out of bounds. So we've seen a record number of people saying that they want to destroy the status quo or look for a strong man to fix everything. And that's where we see stronger support for authoritarian practices. So when you see a system that is so broken, and again, by design in this case, it creates the fertile ground for people to just want to start over. And that is a very dangerous place to be. And then you also mentioned
we got to go to a break here. So we're going to pick up the conversation when we come back from the break. We're talking about a new report titled "Barrier to Benefits: The Decline of Public Trust." It's an analysis of states like Texas, includes Texas, looking at how things like the One Big Beautiful Bill undermines three major pillars of the U.S. social safety net, and that leads to overall disenchantment with the government and maybe opens the door to authoritarianism. If you want to call in, we want to hear from you, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues after a one-minute break. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. They are committed to helping policyholders build strong and thriving businesses through their exceptional service. More at texasmutual.com/texansdeliver. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Omar Parabu. He is the Chief Executive Officer at Innovating for the Public Good, R&D for Democracy. They just released a report, Barriers to Benefits to Decline in Public Trust. It details what individuals need to do in order to qualify for help in states like Texas and how that experience can be at times a humiliating experience, and that it erodes public trust in the government. And that also erodes trust in things like democracy. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Have you ever had to go through these processes, these Kafkaesque processes to try to qualify for these programs? What was it like? How did it make you feel? We'd love to hear from you, 833-877-8255. So, Omar, like recently, we had this disaster locally. We're still dealing with it up in Kerr County, flooding. And people there wanted support, wanted help from FEMA. And their reaction, in testimony, I heard people expressing their frustration that they felt that FEMA wasn't working, that it was broken, wasn't providing them the support that they needed. And so they said, we need to abolish FEMA. They didn't say we need to reform FEMA, we need to fix FEMA. They're saying we need to abolish FEMA, which if I don't, you know, how that helps. But, you know, is that sort of the reaction that you're seeing?
Yeah, we do see that. And obviously my heart goes out to those families who have been impacted by those floods. And I completely understand the sentiment. I'm from Louisiana, and we had a very similar experience during Katrina and our reactions to FEMA. But the idea of abolishing FEMA is relatively new, and the solutions that people are jumping to, which is to, again, dismantle the government as opposed to having government serve them better, is part of a broader program to get people to feel like the government is not something that helps them, that the government is at best something you don't have to deal with, or at worst in the way. That is not going to serve anybody, and it does not make America a stronger country. What we need to do, and this is what we focus on at Innovating for the Public Good, is thinking very concretely about the broader ecosystem in which people are operating to try to design for the entire experience, from the narratives people hear and believe, to the experiences they have with government, to the way they engage with one another, to make sure that people understand that there is a better, more affirmative future in which government is actually working well and serving the people. And that is a better alternative to a system where things are just thrown out.
So another point here, Medicaid was cut in the big, beautiful bill, over $1 trillion a cut for the next 10 years, largest reduction in the program's history. Affordable Care Act also, enhanced subsidies will expire at the end of 2025. Increasing out-of-pocket costs by over 75% on average, resulting in approximately 4.2 million people losing their coverage. Now, we're seeing this rural hospital crisis here in Texas. Rural hospitals are closing. It's very difficult for them to remain open, and they're seeing these cuts as may possibly the last nail in the coffin for them. They, you know, we've heard from experts in rural hospitals in Texas saying they're not going to be able to function with these cuts from the big, beautiful bill. But now we're seeing today, the Sid Miller, the Texas Secretary of Agriculture, he puts out an op-ed celebrating the big, beautiful bill, calls it a Texas-sized win for rural health care, because the bill, Big Beautiful Bill, includes a $50 billion fund to assist rural hospitals. But so what doesn't seem to work, understand, if you don't have the Medicaid, if you don't have affordable health care, then you can't go to the hospital. If you don't have the insurance, if you don't have a way to pay for it, it doesn't matter if they're able to support and actually provide direct funds to the hospitals to remain open if the people who need the care can't afford to go there. I mean, the money would have been better spent not to make those cuts.
That's exactly right. I mean, subsidies to these rural hospitals are not a replacement for a good business model. And when you are cutting out the customers for these rural hospitals, you can't just add more money into coffers and assume that's going to work. We also know that those subsidies are far short of what a lot of these rural hospitals need. So it is a band-aid solution that's meant to obfuscate rather than solve a problem for it. And I think what we need to make clear is that this doesn't work for people, and people need to be able to speak out and voice that opinion, not just those whose benefits are being directly impacted, but all of us. When a rural hospital closes, it impacts that entire community. And there's, you know, a lot of...
Yeah, we've seen counties depopulate when they lose their rural hospitals.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So we need to make sure that people understand that things aren't necessarily hopeless or set in stone, that there is still time and efforts that can happen to push back on a lot of this. You know, these impacts that we're talking about are happening over a course of 10 years, and you know, the train is already out of the station. We have to acknowledge that. But we know that there is a lot of work being done to disempower the voices of the many, not because we don't have power, but because there's fear of these very unpopular policies having a backlash. So what's happening right now in your state around redistricting is a perfect example of that, where instead of solving the needs of the people, power is instead consolidated and disproportionately going to a smaller number of people as opposed to reflecting the actual will of the populace at large. So it is, again, the bill is one big part of it, but there is a broader concerted effort to consolidate the kind of power that allows a bill like this to go through. And what we are thinking about at Innovating for the Public Good is to take that same broad aperture and start designing things in the opposite direction, innovating so that people have the power again, that we have a thriving and effective democracy once again.
So according to your report, the Big Beautiful Bill, and as you call it, the Big Betrayal Bill, talks about that the bill weaponizes bureaucracy, making it harder to apply for, stay enrolled in, or even understand what's required in order to receive basic support. And that's how trust in government is eroded. But how does that also keep people in poverty?
Well, it is the people who are most vulnerable who are being asked to take on these burdens. And they are the ones who likely have the least time, cognitive space to deal with this because they are dealing with so much of it. So what happens in reality is that they fall off the rolls. These are people who are eligible because they are under or close to the poverty line. And now the support that has kept them somewhat afloat is going to go away and just further entrench the poverty they're facing. So when somebody is unable to go and do their interview for SNAP benefits, for example, then they will fall off the rolls 3 months later. That's problematic. That's food. That's clothing. That's helping children.
And so these benefit restrictions, they align really with these long-term conservative strategies in order to shrink the welfare state. That is something we've heard forever. But is the reduction in public trust, is that also an intention, or is that just an unintended consequence?
It is absolutely an intention. When you reduce public trust, then you reduce people's willingness to go to bat for better government services. Like you mentioned earlier, the idea of dismantling FEMA is what happens when people are fed a narrative of distrust for the government. It is a way of getting people on board with the idea that government doesn't work. It starts with a proclamation that things aren't working properly, and then they make that real by doing these kind of bills that add burden and make government actually not work as well. So then people see the evidence, and then it becomes this vicious cycle. But it doesn't have to be. And I do want to also push back on, you know, who's supporting this? There is an agenda here, but that agenda, even if it falls within a specific party, is still one that does not have a lot of support, even among Republicans. We've seen studies that show that Democrats and Republicans support policies that put more of a burden on the state rather than on the individuals to act to benefit. They understand that having this kind of sludge in place is not good policy. We want to make sure that people who shouldn't be accessing benefits don't access them. That's fine. But to say that people who can't fill out a 40-page form shouldn't have benefits, it goes a little too far for people across the political spectrum.
Let's just talk about those 40-page forms, all that red tape they ask people to fill out. The government has all that information already about people. They don't really need everyone to fill out a new 40-page form each and every time that they come in contact with the government. As a matter of fact, the government has more information about each and every one of us now than it's ever had in the past. It just sort of underscores the fact that it's really unnecessary in order to ask that much of any individual. I mean, you could probably just give your name and Social Security and your date of birth or something else, name of your first dog, and they'll pull up your whole life story on their computers. Why do you got to fill out a 40-page form?
Yeah, even if you made the argument that there's some additional information that's required, because these are means-tested programs, you don't need 30 to 40 pages to get that information. I mean, I look at programs like Social Security retirement benefits, and there's 100% uptake or close to it, because it's very easy to start getting those benefits. But then when you look at disability insurance, Social Security disability insurance, you're closer to the 60% range of people who are eligible for those benefits actually taking them up because of the additional administrative burdens that are required to sign up for those benefits. That is not necessary, but it's a way of controlling costs. It's a way of controlling people who some think are undeserving of this benefit. And it is arguably completely unnecessary.
Do you think by pointing out that there is a deliberate orchestrated campaign to erode public trust, and then people will then be able to identify it and see it, and that is a way to counter that erosion?
I don't think so. I don't think it's that simple.
I mean, you tell people, hey, you're being played. You know, the game is rigged, yo. You need to do, you know, don't, yeah, you're falling into the trap.
There's a bit of catch-22 there, right? When we start raising the alarm bells, people will start feeling that the system is actually rigged, and then further entrenches more negative feelings that are hard to get people out of.
So reform is possible. These things can be reformed. They can be changed. This is, you know, government doesn't have to be this way. It's all by design. We get different people in power and things could be different.
That's right. Then that's the message, right? You have to couple it with an affirmative vision of how things can and should be so that people see solutions that are commensurate with the scale of the problem and believe that there is a way to get there. Otherwise, if we just say things are bad and we don't know what to do about them other than be angry, we're not serving anybody yet.
So having these conversations, I mean, it can be beneficial in trying to change that paradigm?
Absolutely. And the work we're doing at Innovating for the Public Good is thinking more holistically about not only getting this information out, but starting to build that affirmative future, investing and the solutions that will get us to a better place and getting more people to pay attention to the fundamental challenges we're facing in our democracy, as opposed to focusing just on these very, very bad symptoms and only focusing solutions on trying to mitigate those.
And telling people, things can't be better. You have to just demand better from our government. You can do that.
Exactly.
Omar Pabu, he is the Chief Executive Officer at Innovating for the Public Good. Thank you so much, Omar, for joining us today.
Yeah, but it was a real pleasure. I appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
That's The Source. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.